Hello and welcome to Tech Shock from ParentZone, the podcast that looks at the impact of digital technologies on family life for parents, teachers, professionals and policymakers. I'm Vicky Shockwalt, CEO of ParentZone, and I'm here with Geraldine Bedell, Executive Editor at ParentZone. This is the last in our current series, so we're going to look back at the highlights, at the way ParentZone's work has been developing since January, and we're going to discuss some of the issues that have been swirling around families and technology. What did you make of the latest series, Geraldine?
I thought it was great. I thought that it was probably our best so far. And it was interesting because without really setting out to focus around themes, somehow several themes emerged. So we had misinformation as a big theme. Charles Creel was our first guest. And if you remember, he was talking about how COVID misinformation has spread, bringing together wellness enthusiasts with the far right in a rather sort of toxic mixture. And then we had Frank Kelly from the Royal Society talking about the impact on science of misinformation, and again talking about COVID, I guess. And then last week we had Faith Rogo talking about the role of media literacy in countering that. And then, of course, we had Natalie Foos and Mark Feldman talking about the fascinating topic of Munchausen by internet. And then the second theme, I suppose, we had is pornography. We have the Children's Commissioner, Dame Rachel D'Souza, talking about rape culture in schools and the Everyone's Invited phenomenon, which blew up just as she was becoming Children's Commissioner. And she's made sexual harassment and rape culture a big priority for her period in office. And we had Ellie Hansen a couple of weeks ago highlighting the proven links between porn and that sort of behaviour, rape culture kind of behaviour. And John Carr reflecting on how far the Online Safety Bill is going to protect children from pornography. And all that discussion has been taking place against the background of the Online Safety Bill, because when the draft was first published, it wasn't in scope. And now that the second reading is taking place, it is in scope. So that's very good news. And then finally, the last theme, I guess, that we talked about was gaming and gambling. And two of the leading researchers into the links between gaming and gambling featured on the podcast this season, David Zendel and Heather Wardle. And that led to some really interesting conversations. So I guess misinformation was really interesting because media literacy has been a kind of vital underlying principle of ParentZone's work for years, although we haven't always been that explicit about it. We haven't always talked about it in that way. It's becoming much more of a preoccupation now, and the government has introduced media literacy and emphasised its importance alongside the Online Safety Bill. So I guess our work has had to develop to reflect that.
It definitely has. And, you know, it was particularly lovely to talk to Faith Rogo, who wrote some of the content for the Be Internet Legends curriculum, which we've been working on that programme for several years now. And she was involved in the American version of the curriculum that we deliver to primary schools around the country. But I do think it's been really interesting this season how some of the debates feel as though they're starting to mature. Some of the really knotty things that we need to tackle, like media literacy, are really coming to the fore. And I think one of the things that Faith was so interesting in about talking about was that question of how do you take media literacy to much younger audiences, because our work starts in primary school, but she was talking about preschool children. And, you know, I think even though you can see that this space is maturing, there are still some audiences like preschool kids who are not often thought about when we think about online safety.
No, and I thought that was really interesting because one of the questions I had was, how do you do that without making young children mistrustful? If you're going to tell them to mistrust the world around them, you're also telling them to mistrust authority, which is precisely what you don't want a two-year-old to do. So I thought she was very interesting about all that.
What I loved about that was that she gave some really practical examples, things that parents do anyway and very naturally, like, you know, who told you that, and you know, why are you doing that, those sorts of natural conversations that are actually building skills that children will need as they grow into older children and young adults. And of course, she was shared one of the messages that we give to parents all the time, which is keeping children away from screens isn't the answer. And even if you think you're doing it, you're probably not, because they'll be seeing you using a screen for work and their friends will be using screens and they'll be using screens in school at sometime soon. So I thought that was really reassuring, I guess.
Yeah, I thought that was reassuring and also very interesting, because lots of parents do think, well, I won't let them have screens until they're X age. But nevertheless, they're on screens themselves. And so screens are an integral part of children's world. And pretending that they're not is only going to work up to a certain point, I think. So I did think that was really interesting. And I thought she was great also about talking about how children should be aware that all media is made. So, you know, it doesn't have to be online, but just looking at a storybook and asking why the picture is the way it is, or why a poster is saying something it's saying, encourages children to ask who made the piece of media and what was their intention in doing that. And I thought that was a really good way of thinking about it, that would give you lots of kind of age appropriate strategies to talk to children. And I suppose the pandemic has sort of brought all that to the fore, because it's shown parents not only that children need to be on screens, but also it's brought us all into a great awareness of misinformation, not least because of anti-vaxxer information and COVID misinformation. And our first podcast of the season had Charles Creel talking exactly about that.
He was great, wasn't he? Although I seem to remember us both being a little bit disappointed that he didn't in fact turn out to be a spy, which is what we thought he was when we first...
He had worked in Iraq and he was onto Cambridge Analytica very early.
He had all of the criteria for being a spy, but turned out he wasn't. He wasn't at all. But when he talked about yoga moms being involved with anti-vax disinformation, that really resonated with me, because it aligns so perfectly to that thing that we know to be true, which is that parents really want to do their best for their children. And sometimes in practice, that's quite hard, and it's easy to fall into these disinformation traps. And I think that's always been the case. I remember my mother used to put butter on burns because her mother had told her that it soothed them. And it didn't, it just sauteed you. And I think that disinformation that parents kind of lap up if it touches that nerve that is, do this because it's the best thing you can do for your children. I think parents can be very vulnerable to that. And that's why the work that we do with programmes like Resilient Families, where we're talking about parenting primarily, but also how you need to be able to distill what's accurate and evidence-based from what's, you know, popular myth. And even if that's spreading through your mum friends, is really relevant now, I think.
I thought he was really interesting because he talked about how a lot of conspiracy theories are framed around protecting children, and that obviously appeals to parents, especially when they're in a slightly vulnerable situation. When, you know, he talked about how misinformation was being spread by pregnancy apps, for example. And then he was also interesting about how people don't want to admit they're wrong. So once people get hold of one of these conspiracy theories, it's very difficult to relinquish it. And the other thing I thought he was really good on was that sense that conspiracy theories impose order on chaos. I thought that was a good explanation of why they're so potent and they have such tight hold on people.
He was very convincing on that, and it really made so much sense. And of course, his conclusion, I guess, was that he believed that legislation was needed really urgently, which I think, you know, is also a very compelling call to action, isn't it? But then I compare and contrast that podcast with the one that we did with Frank Kelly, and I remember being slightly taken aback and then completely persuaded by something that he said, which was, well, you know, how do you know what's fake? Because even in science, there are arguments rage, and it's really important that they do, about what is a fact, because sometimes a fact is simply as much as we know right now. And I thought he was very convincing on that too. And you can see how those two things feed into parents' desire to find the best thing for their child and the thing that will keep them healthy and resilient and happy and all of those important things, when sometimes we actually don't even know the answers, which I think was Frank Kelly's point about science. It is by nature exploratory, and we have to leave room and space for that exploration.
Yeah, I thought he was very sensible, and I liked the way he talked about the fact that misinformation had always existed. And as you say, that uncertainty is the basis of science, and without asking questions and querying information, you can't move forward. And I also thought he was, as you also suggested, very interesting on the subject of censorship, which he said is not particularly helpful because there's a loss of trust when you start censoring. If people already don't believe the government or have faith in the public health system, if you then start censoring information, they become even more mistrustful. Although he did say that he thought there was a space for limiting the kind of algorithmic amplification of that kind of misinformation, which has to be done, I guess, by legislation, given that it's not going to be done by self-regulation.
I think the other thing that I really took away from talking to Frank was how important it was to focus on numeracy. I think when we talk about media literacy, we quite often think of literacy in the old-fashioned sense, if I can characterise it like that, but we don't very often talk about numeracy. And he was pointing to the appalling use of statistics sometimes, which made us both laugh, I think, but also acknowledge that analysing data is not something that people are typically all that enthusiastic about doing, and not necessarily that confident in doing. I think when it comes to numbers, lots of people feel less confident than they do around the written word.
Yes, I think we had a good conversation about that too. Innumerate people, largely innumerate, admitting that they shouldn't admit that they're innumerate, and that that we shouldn't be proud of it.
Yeah, I think I put myself forward for that one. But it's true, isn't it? We look at statistics, and they're often presented. I mean, he gave the example of the media often covering statistics in ways that make him really, you know, say, well, that's just not correct. That's not what those statistics are telling us. So, you know, it's a reminder to all of us, isn't it, that we really do need to scrutinise our sources.
And then, on that note, we had a really interesting conversation with Natalie Foose and Mark Feldman, which came out of the VoiceBox works.
It did indeed. And VoiceBox is so important to the work that we do at Parents Own, because it is a small startup social enterprise run by young people that aims to give young people a space to talk about whatever they want to talk about and to amplify their voices. And that's important to us because young people are often at the cutting edge of new trends online and new problems online. So having this space where we have a constant flow of that information and that intelligence, if you like, is really important to us at Parents Own. And VoiceBox came up with this report, Munchausen's by Internet, which looks at people portraying mental health illnesses online that they may or may not have the one that they're portraying, but you know, clearly there are underlying issues that are going on that are really, really complex, really difficult to unpack. And I thought Natalie and Mark Feldman were fantastic on it. I think what's been interesting following on from that report is that VoiceBox have found it really difficult to get anybody to engage in that conversation. It's almost as though we've touched on a conversation that's too difficult for the adult among us, the adult organisations to engage with.
I think it is really, really difficult because young people particularly have fought so hard to get mental health issues taken seriously, and someone popping up and saying, oh, but, you know, they may not really be mental health issues, they may be trolling, is not terribly helpful to those who have mental health issues, or is perceived as not being terribly helpful. So it's a really complex issue. And also you can't tell, I think, very often with people who have Munchausen by Internet, whether they are trolling or whether they are themselves, almost by definition really, sick, you know, that it is in itself a disorder. So I think it threw up lots of really fascinating issues. And it's such a shame that Natalie and Voicebox have found it difficult to get traction with it, if they have, because it's so important, I think, to discuss these things.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I mean, they talked about the scale of the issue and how many hashtags, like hashtag fake Tourette's, has millions of followers. So it's a big issue, and it's one of those that young people are sort of navigating by themselves online and experiencing. And I think it's when things are really complicated that it's even more important for us to be brave enough to step in and offer support. Although, totally take on board your point, this one of all the subjects we dealt with is one that is really hard to get right. I mean, to talk about sensitively even.
It's a kind of phenomenon of the internet age, I think, that everything gets sort of divided into either or black and white, if you like. And it reminds me that Frank Kelly talked about all the things between zero and one. And I loved that image of there being a whole spectrum of grey areas between zero and one. And I think the same is true probably of Munchausen by internet. It's an illness. It's not the illness it claims to be necessarily. It may be trolling in some circumstances, but often the people seek no money or no reward other than sympathy. So it's an incredibly grey area, and as you say, it calls for nuance and thoughtfulness and reflective discussion about it, not for pretending it doesn't exist, really. Pornography, moving on to our next big topic, less of a grey area, I would say. This was such a recurrent theme that at one point you said to me, please, no more pornography.
It is, as you say, one of those subjects that just won't go away. We don't seem to be able to deal with it. But we tried, didn't we?
So we started off on this subject with Dame Rachel D'Souza, who is the Children's Commissioner. And she told a story that's really stuck with me about a 15-year-old girl who had her first kiss with her boyfriend who tried to strangle her because he thought that is what you did when you kiss someone, because all his education about romance and sex had come from pornography. So I found that really shocking. And, you know, that's just one story, but she suggested that pornography was ubiquitous among young people. And she said that half of 11 to 12-year-olds had seen it and two-thirds of 13 to 16-year-olds. So it's a big, big issue.
Yeah, and it's another one of those issues where I feel as though if we were to be scored as a generation of parents, we'd probably get a D- on this one, because we've seen young people come forward and start to talk about the rape culture they're having to live with in schools. We saw the everyone's invited movement. And yet for a long time, anyone who dared to say, perhaps we need to look at pornography, and particularly the sort of hardcore pornography that sites like Pornhub freely make available. If you did that, you were stuck in the Mary Whitehouse corner and told that you are somehow some silly old fart with regressive views, and that you needed to be more sex positive. And I think it's an area where for quite some years we've been saying it is problematic for there to be no age verification on hardcore pornography sites. It's not right that children should be seeing this stuff in schools. And what we're seeing now are the actual impacts of allowing that porn culture to grow. And it's become totally normalised now. I hope, thank goodness, the Online Safety Bill has said it's going to include age verification for porn sites. And we've got the cyber flashing law, hopefully, coming into play. So, you know, maybe we're at a tipping point where people have finally said porn on this scale for young people is not okay.
Yes, and I think you made that very good point in the Ellie Hansen podcast when you talked about having been accused of being mumsy and illiberal years ago when you first started talking about this. And Ellie made also the very good point that we've sort of moved beyond illiberal versus liberal, free versus puritanical, because actually what's happened is that one side has said sexual freedom at all costs and the other side has said market freedom at all costs. And somehow porn is allowed to kind of get away with it. The pornography industry is allowed to kind of get off scot-free.
She made so many good points, didn't she? Although that phrase that she used, the wide sticky net of online porn, still sends a bit of a shudder down my spine, I must say. But she made the very convincing point that actually we've heard made before by Jonathan Bagley in the last season, Jono from the PSHG Association, that actually these companies are data companies and that they are not just providing pornography, they are guiding sexual choices, and that some of the behaviours that they're normalising are having a wider social effect. They're leading to unethical behaviour in the workplace, for example, which I thought was fascinating, that kind of undermining effect that porn has on society.
Yeah, I completely agree. I thought she was very good on all of that, and I was really shocked by a number of things that she said. And as you say, that point about the wider social implications of people being more selfish and objectifying others more was really shocking. And the other thing I found really shocking was that she talked about kind of consensual, in inverted commas, violence in pornography, and that for young women, the new taboo had become expressing any pain, either physical or emotional, because that contradicted the narrative of the kind of always up for it, sexy young woman. And that seemed to me incredibly sad.
Incredibly sad, and that violence has become so inextricably linked to sex. And one of the top search terms that she talked about was incest porn. When on earth did that become normalised? She was a real eye-opener, I think, Ellie, and very convincing, because she has been researching, she's an academic, she's been researching this subject area, and I think what she was saying quite clearly was that we do now have an evidence base, and those days when people can say, well, where's the harm, you can't prove it, have well and truly passed, which presumably is one of the reasons why finally the government have been persuaded to include pornography in the Online Safety Bill, which is what we chatted to John Carr about early in the season, I think.
Yeah, and I think it was really interesting because that happened during this podcast season and we are all very pleased about it. I think it's fair to say tech companies, including pornography companies, will now have a legal obligation to show that they have the wherewithal to protect children. They'll have to say how they're going to do that, and then Ofcom will have the power to demand information about how well they're doing it. And so that will make a huge difference. It will mean that there will be age verification, and of course, you know, all the usual problems remain about children being able to get around these things through VPNs or whatever. But the fact is that a lot of children who come across porn accidentally, which is how many children access it currently for the first time at any rate, that won't happen. So in quite the same way. So that, I thought, was a good move and a good development.
Definitely. Does it mean that parents can stop talking to their children about porn? Unfortunately not, because as she's
absolutely
saying,
not.
Absolutely not. There will be ways around it. And I think one of the outstanding questions I know people are very concerned about in our space is the enforcement question, because at the moment it looks as though the proposals are that that Ofcom will have to go to court in order to compel a porn company to put in place age verification if they're found not to have done. So in other words, if they're not complying with the bill. And that delay, that timeline, means that there could be financial encouragement for companies to carry on not conforming, because it'll be a huge commercial advantage if you can just play out through the courts for, even if it's only several months, at non-enforcement of age verification. So there are still questions. We're not there yet. It's not across the line yet, as the Children's Commissioner was keen to point out. It's not done, and it's not in legislation until it's actually done and on the statute book. But it's good news, I think.
It is good news. It is good news. And I find that enforcement question so palpably ridiculous that I wonder if, as the bill is passing through Parliament, something might be done about that. Because it seems to me ridiculous that it could take 3 years for Ofcom to enforce its rulings. There's no need for that to be the case. And that could be how long it takes if they have to go to court. And as John said, you know, that's money for the porn companies. So there will be an incentive.
I do think the policymakers should get us into the House of Commons, Geraldine,
so we can sort them out. We can sort them out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then finally, I guess our last theme that we followed this year was gambling, and we had both David Zendel and Heather Wardle talking about the overlap between gaming and gambling, and that has very strong links to the work that we've been doing.
We've been doing this work for so many years. I mean, it feels like one of those things where I think, surely we'll see legislative progress on this. And yet, you talk to Heather and David and think, crikey, no. The problems are still there. We still have a Gambling Act being reviewed. We're still asking that question about whether or not loot boxes should be classified as gambling. And actually, the thing that David talked about, which was really troubling, was the idea that as we start to contemplate somebody or another building the metaverse, whether it's Facebook as was or EA Games or whoever ends up doing it, some of those exploitative financial mechanisms that have been perfected in the gaming world are going to come across into this new metaverse. And, you know, the online safety bill didn't even, I think twice it mentioned gaming. I was going to say it didn't even mention it. It barely mentioned gaming. So it's a huge space that still needs a lot of work.
Yes, it is. I thought that was really telling too. And I also thought that David's call for a regulator for gaming was a good call, because the online safety bill, as we've discussed many times, is complex and rather Byzantine, and it probably doesn't need any more bits added in, thrown in. And also, gaming is very complex and very particular, and the gambling regulator certainly hasn't got to grips with it. And as David said, it's changing very fast all the time as well. He gave a great example of EA with its FIFA Superstar Legends game, where everything depends on the quality of your players. And they have actually, probably in response to the furore about loot boxes, started making the first loot box transparent, the one you can see, but you can't see the one behind that. And when you get to that, you can't see the one behind that. So there are all kinds of stories, according to David, of children and young people just going through the loot boxes in the same way that they always did, hoping to get to the one that they really want. So the industry is really agile and the issues are complex, and I think he's right that we could do with a regulator who really understands what's going on.
Absolutely. And I think that's really important, and I hope it's going to form part of our work over the next few months. Because as Heather rightly pointed out, we actually don't know what the impact is going to be on the generation that has literally just grown up with loot boxes, whether or not they're going to turn out to have a greater propensity to having a problem relationship with gambling. So, you know, it feels as though we've let one generation down, and we ought to try and make sure that we don't let another generation down. And it does have echoes to me of pornography. You know, I don't think we want to get to the point where young people in 5 years' time say there's this huge problem with gambling, although to some extent they're already saying that. But I think a gaming regulator could really be timely.
One of the interesting things, I guess, about gambling and gaming is that the academics admit that they haven't been able to prove a causal link, although they have proved overwhelmingly that the two things are related. But they haven't been able to disprove a causal link either. And the reason they haven't been able to do it is that they simply don't get any information from the gaming companies. And it's rather like social media and Ofcom. You know, Ofcom is now going to be enabled to demand information, the kind of information you need to see what's going on. And we sort of need to know what's going on, I think.
You really do. And I think our starting point might be the same starting point that it's been in the past with gaming, which is to talk to young gamers. Because I remember the report that you wrote about the rip-off games. Some of those techniques that young gamers were talking about were things that hadn't hit our radar at all. And some of them were incredibly exploitative. I mean, even fairly transparently exploitative, like releasing a game that wasn't fit to play. Just extraordinary. So a great season overall. Crikey, so many topics that we've run through, so many amazing guests. Lots of issues that we've covered before, but some new issues and definitely some underlying themes that are becoming quite familiar. And I guess that's what we try and draw out in this podcast. But before we wrap up our season end, is there anything else that stood out for you as a bit of a favourite, your favourite moment, anything you would draw attention to?
We had Michelle Druin on, and she talked about the link between smart technology and our intimate relationships. And she said that if she and her husband are watching television and she picks up her phone and starts scrolling, he puts it on pause. And that has really stuck with me. I haven't actually done it yet, but every time my husband picks up his phone, I think about doing it. And I am going to do it one day and see what reaction I get. But I do think it's really interesting. You know, it's a sort of, I was thinking about it the other day. We were, you know, I was in a cafe somewhere and the person I was with picked up their phone and I thought, this is so insulting. You know, am I so boring that these little pointless dopamine hits are much, much better fun than me?
Yeah, and it's interesting to see, did you see over the weekend Joe Wicks talking about the fact, Joe Wicks, the fitness chap, you see, somebody describing someone, I don't do a lot of fitness work, but he's talking about his toxic relationship with his phone, and, you know, I think there's something about that device that is uniquely addictive, to use a word that I don't like using very much, but... I think, you know, mine, I keep going back to Frank Kelly. I just thought he was so interesting on data and science, and it felt like such an important element that we don't very often talk about. That I loved it. But the one that I really enjoyed this season was the one that I didn't do. It was listening to Tim Gill. Been able to listen as a consumer, a listener, as opposed to a podcaster. And again, partly because it's an area we've done so much work in and we're so interested in, but Tim Gill is the expert on play, and it was just fascinating to hear him join the dots between digital play and offline play.
Yes, and no surprises really. A lot of the issues are the same, and children need freedom to play, not constraining. Yeah, very, very good. So it's been a good season, and that gives us lots to think about over the summer. What's coming up for Parent Zone in the next few months?
Well, without wanting to do any spoilers, I think we might have already got a spoiler alert, but looking at those questions around gaming and gambling and perhaps a gaming regulator, I think you and I are going to be taking that away, are we not, to look at with our policy goggles on. We've also got some really interesting work that we've been doing around creating resources or using our resources and making them more accessible to people with special educational learning needs and disabilities, which I think is a piece of work we're going to carry on. But one of the things that we've been working really hard on, and I don't think we've quite bottomed out, but we keep trying, is how do you deliver media literacy and interventions that help families enjoy the internet safely at a really hyper-local level. And so our PZ local work continues to keep us up at night because we think there's more that we can do and we haven't quite figured out exactly how to do it, but we're going to keep trying.
Brilliant. Well, we'll be back in the autumn and with luck we should have more to talk about with all of that.
Well, it's been fun podcasting for another season with you, Geraldine.
And with you.
I look forward to the autumn.
We'll meet again soon.
We will, through our headphones.